Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hardacre by C.L. Skelton, narrated by Justine Eyre. Book 1. The Gutty. Chapter 1. Sam Hardacre stamped his hobnailed boots on the gut-soaked cobblestones in an abortive attempt to restore the circulation to his freezing feet. His numb fingers, great red gobs sticking out of the filthy hessian strips that bound his hands, worked automatically, with an instinct born of many years spent standing behind a gutting bench. Sam was a master of his trade. His left hand held the herring, his right the gutting knife, a razor-sharp piece of steel with a wooden handle bound with string. It was all one movement, as rhythmic as if it had been orchestrated. Knife in, down the back of the fish, leaving the bone on the left as it sliced the creature open, while his right thumb dug the gut from the body and into the gut bucket, and then, while the herring was still in the air on its way to the barrel, the knife was already ripping open the next. A layer of herring in the barrel, and a pause while Sam spread a layer of salt and ice. A muttered oath as the salt bit deep into the open wound, where the blade of the knife had slipped across his thumb half a barrel ago. A quick suck at the throbbing thumb spit the muck into the gut bucket, and the next fish was already being ripped open.
God, it's bloody cold!
And it would get colder. December was only weeks away. The day was dull and drab, posing the threat of a hard winter. The biting November wind whipped in from the dirty grey of the North Sea. The daily race of the herring drifters, each piling on its canvas in a desperate attempt to be first home to market, was over. The last boat had dropped her stained brown sails and was unloading the last of her baskets on the quay. In November 1885, there was a depressing sameness about the fish quays of Britain. Grimsby, at the mouth of the Humber just south of the Yorkshire border, differed from the rest only in that it was larger, noisier, and more nauseating than most. Square wooden pillars supported long curved roofs. Below them it was open on all four sides to the elements. The creaking and groaning of the derricks as they heaved their slithering contents from the fish holds was followed by the screech of rope through pulley as the straining muscles of the seamen relaxed and the basket was run onto the quay. Then there was the constant mewing of the gulls, who carpeted the roofs of the sheds dirty white and grey with their excrement. The birds launched themselves into the air after every discarded piece of fish or offal, competing for the scraps with the flotsam of near-starving humanity who had found no work. The raucous shouting of the auctioneers, unintelligible to all save the buyers, the constant brawling of the casual labourers as they fought over what work there was to be had, and, on the landward side of the sheds, emaciated horses standing between the shafts of wagons and rattling away over the cobbles as soon as they had loaded, and everything overlaid with the stench of fish, whose guts and slime covered building, boxes, carts and men. Sam Hardacre looked up for a moment, glancing at the fish porters who were busy filling barrels and heaving them to the gutting benches. A gutty's livelihood depended on these men. Sam was nearly out of fish. Another barrel would be his fourth, and at sixpence a time that would make a fair day's wages. Damn the bloody thumb! It was slowing him down. Slice, gut, slice, gut. He glanced up again and caught the eye of a porter whom he knew.
Fucking crook! Sam spat contemptuously.
The porter caught his eye and nodded. Sam knew that it would cost him a halfpenny, but he would get his barrel. Maybe even two. Sam sucked his aching thumb and spat again as the porter dumped the barrel at his bench. He laid the halfpenny on the table and watched the porter's grimy hand close over it.
Get us another one. It'll cost you. Halfpenny. Penny.
Sam's knife came up, the point half an inch from the other man's nose.
It won't only be fish guts on here if I don't see that other barrel.
The porter ducked back and swallowed hard.
There's no need for that, Sam. I was only joking. I'll get thee barrel.
There were not many men who would argue with Sam Hardacre.
And thou'll get bugger all for thee asking, growled Sam.
He grinned as the porter scuttled off, knowing that he would get his fifth barrel. 2 shillings and 6 pence, less a halfpenny, and add to that 3 pence from the guano or fish glue factory for the gut. He had had a good day. He would buy a mutton pie for their supper, fresh milk for the kids, and a glass of stout for Mary. Even among that tough breed of men who, summer and winter, sweated and froze on the fish quays, Sam Hardacre was a commanding presence. 6 feet of weather-beaten brawn and muscle, close-cropped sandy brown hair, blue-eyed, firm-jawed, and carrying not 1 ounce of spare flesh. He had for 13 years been tramping around Britain in the wake of the herring fleet. On that November Thursday in 1885, he'd been working at Grimsby for a month. On the following Sunday he would leave, and with Mary and the children and his pony and cart, walk the 50 miles to Bridlington to be ready to meet the first boat in on Tuesday morning. Sam was not looking forward to Brid. Bridlington had no smokehouse, and he could earn nearly half as much again gutting for tappers as he could gutting, skinning and filleting whitefish. But there were not many herring landed at Brid. He consoled himself with the thought that it was not a long stay, 2 weeks only, and then on to Whitby, and there were still 2 more kippering days at Grimsby. The porter brought Sam his 5th barrel.
"That's mine!"
Sam looked up at the owner of the voice, and his eyes narrowed. It was Bill Gormley, a huge man whose belly overflowed the string which supported his shabby, rough, grey serge trousers long since bereft of fly buttons. Gormley had lumbered over from his bench and was holding the little porter by the scruff of the neck.
"Take it to my bench, that bloody little weasel!" he growled.
As the little man squealed, Sam put down his knife, picked up a handful of fish gut and took a pace towards Gormley. The 2 big men stood facing each other over the head of the unfortunate porter.
"Keep out of this, Hardacre. It's my barrel, and this bastard knows it!" snarled Gormley, releasing his hold on the porter. "I'll leave that barrel where it is," said Sam.
The porter stood, rubbing his neck.
"Now get to hell out of here."
The porter, with a frightened glance at both of them, scuttled away. Sam turned back to Gormley.
"Now, if thou wants this barrel, I can bloody well come and get it."
Gormley wanted that barrel. He wanted it very much. But he did not want it enough to welcome the idea of a fight with Sam Hardacre. The trouble was that it had now become a question of face, and face was very important if you wanted to survive on the fish quays. With its usual carrion instinct, a small crowd had begun to gather, offering highly colourful advice to the 2 men. Gormley looked around him. He wanted a way out. He was beaten before he started, and he knew it, but he had to fight. Suddenly, fists clenched and arms flailing, he let out a roar and charged at Sam. Sam moved. The gut in his left hand was rammed into Gormley's wide-open mouth, while his right sank up to his wrist in the other man's beer-sodden belly. Gormley doubled up in agony, retching, spewing fish gut over the cobbles.
"Peelers!" cried a warning voice.
2 guardians of the law were strolling slowly down the quay. In a matter of seconds, all the gutties were back at their benches, bending to their tasks. 1 policeman paused as he was passing Sam's bench.
"Not on my patch," he muttered.
Sam answered him with an expressionless stare, and the policeman moved on. Sam had gutted his last herring. He stood waiting for the smokehouse clerk to check his work, pay him his wage, and collect his 5 barrels. It was 10 hours since he had started. It would have taken less, maybe only 9, had it not been for his injured thumb. Still, 3 pence an hour was not bad pay. The clerk arrived and barely looked at the barrels, for he knew Sam and Sam's work. He counted 5 6-penny pieces onto the gutting bench and moved on. Sam folded a piece of hessian and laid it on his forehead. He bent down and laid the broad leather strap attached to his gut bucket over this and stood up, heaving the stinking bin onto his back. As he passed Bill Gormley's bench, he spat contemptuously. He carried his noisome load up the hill, away from the quay, passing the row of ship's chandlers and sailmakers and pubs, already doing a heavy trade as the men were paid off for the day. The women were there as well. Just now they would cost sixpence. By 9 o'clock the price would have gone down to threepence, and by midnight a penny and whatever they could filch from your pocket. You did not need directions to find the guano factory. You just followed your nose in the direction of the most foul of all the foul smells with which the area abounded, and when it was strong enough to make you want to puke, you were there. When Sam arrived, the foreman, a new man, looked at his bucket.
"It's not full," he said. "I'll give thee twopence for it." "I'll give me threepence, or I'll tip bloody lot over the sodden head," growled Sam. "I'll bloody soon find out if it's full or nay." "All right, all right. I was only joking."
Like hell he was, thought Sam. If he'd been new to the game, like as not he'd have got a penny, and the other twopence would have ended up in that greedy bastard's pocket. Sam grabbed his threepence and made his mark. He was finished for the day. Tomorrow morning, at 5 o'clock, the whole stinking business would start all over again. Sam ripped the rags off his hands and flung them into the gutter. He stamped his way from the guano factory in the direction of his lodgings, about half a mile away. The lodgings occupied by the migrant workers rose in price, commensurate with the distance between them and the stink of the factory. Though when there was an easterly wind, everyone got a bellyful of the stench. First, there were the rotting grey dwellings, built right up to the cracked flagstone pavements. They were streaked with damp from broken gutters, had moulding planked doors, and their broken windows were stuffed with old rags or damp newspapers. The doors he passed opened directly onto a single room, which sometimes housed as many as 10. The only buildings of any substance were the smithy, with its smell of coke fires and the ring of hammer upon anvil, and the stables, open gaps between the buildings, reeking of horse manure. At first, there were as many as 3 pubs to the street, barely distinguishable from the houses which surrounded them, except for the raucous noise from within, as men and women sought oblivion in gin at a penny a glass. As Sam neared his lodgings, the buildings began to give way to neater and more completely residential streets. Here the houses presented a solid face of red brick on either side of the street, with neatly painted doors and white pumice stone steps. They were 2 stories high and built in groups of 8. Between the groups were alleyways leading to a back lane. The lane was flanked by 6-foot brick walls with gates leading into a paved yard behind each house, each of which contained a washing line, a coal shed, and a privy which housed an earth closet. Some of the houses in Reed Street were occupied by single families, but most of them were let off in single rooms, each house having 2 large ones in the front and 2 smaller ones in the rear. Sam's particular landlord lived in one of the houses on the block, half of which he owned. He let out most of his rooms to shop workers and the more respectable of the not quite poor, but he had a few regulars among the migrants, all decent and respectable, one of whom was Sam Hardacre. Most of the streets, and Reed Street was no exception, boasted their corner shop, where, with commendable loyalty, the inhabitants of the street did all of their food shopping. The corner shop sold practically everything edible: eggs, meat, cheese, pies, cakes. Name it, and you would likely find it at the corner shop. Of course, each corner shop had its own particular specialty, and the shop at the corner of Reed Street made the best mutton pies in Grimsby. Sam went in.
"Give us a mutton pie," he demanded,
standing away from the counter so as not to leave any trace of his odour in the shop.
"Twopence or fourpence?" asked the shopkeeper. "Fourpence," said Sam, without hesitation. "Had a good day then, Sam?"
The shopkeeper knew Sam well.
"Middling. I've got a 4-penny one left over from yesterday, though I can have it for 3 if thou likes."
Sam was tempted, but he turned the offer down, took the fresh one, and went out. He turned into the back lane and entered the yard of his lodgings by the plain wooden gate, which had been newly painted since last year. He ducked carefully under the washing, which was hanging on the line to dry, so as not to stain it with his work clothes. He opened the brown back door and started to climb the bare wooden staircase past the plain, unadorned green and yellow walls. Mary Hardacre had married Sam 11 years ago. During that period, she'd presented him with 4 children, 3 boys and 1 girl. 2 of the boys, Joe and Harry, had beaten the odds stacked against them by society and their environment and had survived. The other boy had been stillborn, and the girl had lived for only 6 weeks. The death of his daughter was the only time in her life that Mary had seen Sam Hardacre cry. She had never lost the vision of him, standing there, the tiny body clutched in his arms, the tears streaming down his cheeks as he cursed the fates that had robbed him of the daughter he'd wanted so dearly. These same lodgings in Grimsby had been their first home. Sam had taken the day off to marry Mary, and in doing so had rescued her from the clutches of a drunkard of a father and a slut of a mother. The room was about 18 feet square. It contained 2 beds with hard mattresses. They supplied their own blankets and pillows. The larger of the beds, of tubular iron with brass rails and knobs, was a good bed, which had obviously started life in better-class surroundings than those in which it was now situated. This was where Sam and Mary slept, between coarse grey blankets, one of which Mary washed every week. The other bed was little more than a wooden pallet, about 3 feet wide, where the boys slept head to toe and took the inside berth against the wall in strict rotation. There were 4 chairs and a scrubbed deal table. The chairs were a hodgepodge of fashions. One was a plain wooden kitchen chair, another an oak wheelback, which had seen better days, while the other 2 came from different upholstered dining suites long since disbanded. One of them still showed patches of the red and yellow Regency-striped damask which had once adorned it, but the other had been covered with a piece of discarded blanket which had been nailed to the frame with carpet tacks. The oblong sash window had a red plush curtain, which was in surprisingly good condition, and it looked out of place against the rather seedy furniture. The most striking item in the room was the range, massive, shining, and black-leaded. On the right was the fireplace, which had 2 hobs that could be swung in over the fire, carrying either pan or kettle, and over the centre of the fire was a large soot-blackened hook from which the soup kettle could be hung. On the fire's left was the oven, with a heavy iron door and shining polished hinges. This was heated by the opening of a flue in the side of the fire. It was used for baking, and on the rare occasions when they had a piece of meat to roast. Over the fireplace was a large mantelpiece, surrounded by a green plush, heavily tasselled pelmet, and to its right a large cupboard. A huge brass fender surrounded the whole of the range. It had a brass stool on each end, the lids of which opened to make a coal box. Their own possessions were stowed away in the cupboard and in the 2 wicker hampers, which had rugs thrown over them to provide additional seating. A couple of rugs on the floor and the aspidistra in an earthenware pot, which Mary took with them everywhere, completed the furnishings. This was Mary's domain. Anything and everything to do with the home was dealt with by her. She always spent the first day in any lodging scrubbing floors, blackleading the range, pounding the mattresses, and searching for bedbugs. When everything was spotless, when every nook and cranny had been dusted or wiped down, then, and not before, would she prepare their first meal. They ate reasonably well, and by the standards of their times, they were not poor. Sam could count on average weekly earnings of around 12 shillings, and that did not include the odd pennies he received from the guano factories. The guano money was sacred. Every penny went into the tin box. This tin box was their treasure chest. It was old and battered and black with a gold line around its middle, but it occupied the place of honour, the centre of the mantelpiece. It contained their marriage lines, the children's birth certificates and the guano money. That money was their emergency fund, to be used only as a last resort when all else had failed. Every now and then they had to dip into it, but this was done only after long and serious consultation. On 18 November 1885, the tin box contained 4 golden sovereigns, 18 shillings in silver, 2 pennies and 1 farthing. Every evening, around 4 o'clock, Mary would start boiling big kettles of water, 1 on each hob over the coal fire. She would get the zinc bath from the corner where it stood on end and place it in the centre of the room in front of the fire. Then she would put the big zinc bucket near the door and fill them both. To do this, she had to draw water from the tap in the yard next to the privy, and it took her 8 trips carrying the heavy kettle up and down the stairs. As soon as she heard Sam on the stairs, she spread yesterday's newspaper over an area of floor just inside the door. Sam came in.
"Hello, wife," he said,
stepping carefully into the centre of the newspaper. He always greeted her as wife, proud of the fact that theirs was a more lasting and respectable relationship than those of most of his acquaintances, who seldom bothered to avail themselves of matrimony.
"Hello, husband," she replied. "Mutton pie," he announced, handing her the paper bag.
She took it unsmiling. She expected no less from her man. Whatever the cost, he would make sure that there was at least one good, belly-filling meal each day.
"Where are the kids?" he asked.
"Playing in the back lane," she replied.
Sam handed over the remains of his day's earnings.
"There's 3 pence for the tin box," he said. "I'll knock and send Joe out for a can of milk and a jug of stout."
"Joe's got his paper round, Sam."
"That's not till 6. There's plenty of time."
"Can we afford it?"
Mary was always cautious.
"Do as I say, Mary."
Sam stripped off his filthy hessian apron and dropped it into the steaming bucket, while Mary ran downstairs to send the boy on his errand. He was almost stripped off when she returned. She collected his outer garments from the newspaper where he had dropped them. His trousers she put over the brass fender to dry out. His socks and shirt she put aside to be washed. She took his long combination underwear over to the bed, where she examined it to see if any darning was needed. But they were all right, so she laid them on the bed for him to wear again after he had got rid of his grime. Sam grinned as he watched her putting the mutton pie into the oven and a pan of peeled potatoes on the hob. Mary was funny that way. She would never look at her husband naked if she could possibly avoid it. So there were only some parts of Sam that Mary knew with her eyes. The wind and salt-tanned face, weathered older than his 35 years. The strong brown throat above the dirty shirt collar. Forearms bare in all weathers and marked with cuts and scars, old and new, of the fish knife. His hands were a working man's hands, broad enough to cover entirely her thin shoulders. Mary could not abide small hands on a man. Her father had them, and she considered them cruel and weak. But now she turned her back on him as he dropped his shirt to the floor and slipped the yellow-white combinations from his shoulders. The white skin of his back, untouched by the sun, was a stranger's skin, unseen and unknown, save by her hands. Their marriage bed was in darkness, and would always be so. Still, the skin was pale and youthful, and had he been a gentleman he would have seemed fair, even blonde. As it was, he was nearer dark, with his brown face and hair too short to show any colour other than sand. His blondness showed in his fair-haired older son, and in his eyes, which salt and wind could not change no matter how they might try. They were simple eyes, simple and plain in colour and in mood. Pure, straight blue, light enough but warm, utterly honest, without depth or mystery. Mary saw them as small boy eyes, more innocent than either of her children's, and wondered, when she was inclined to wonder, how they could have survived, or rather how Sam could have survived, with them so blatantly reflecting honesty in a world where honesty was a dangerous virtue. The answer was that Sam had been blessedly endowed with physical strength, enough to defend his small personal bastion of decency. He was a good 6 feet tall, with the useful muscularity of a survivor. Mary had been very fortunate. With Sam, she and her children would be sheltered and safe. Without him, they most certainly would not. Sam cautiously lowered himself into the zinc tub, and sitting there with his knees up to his chin, he set to work with coarse household soap and scrubbing brush until all of his white body glowed as red as his face. He called Mary, and she came to do her part and scrub his back. She didn't mind doing this. With his private parts submerged, she had less aversion to approaching him than when he was standing with everything in full view. She held the rough towel in front of her face as he rose from his bath, then dropped it over his shoulders. Straight away she busied herself setting the table, while Sam finished drying himself and put on his combination Sanispare corduroy trousers. He pulled a flannel shirt over his head and, tucking it into his trousers, went over to the front window. He pushed up the sash and stuck his head out to make sure there was no one in the street below. Then he took the zinc bath and pitched its contents out onto the road. Their eldest son came into the room carrying the can of milk and the jug of stout. Joe was a miniature of Sam, though it was clear, even at 10, that he was not likely to be as big a man. He had many of Sam's features, each one just a little exaggerated. The sandy brown hair was a little bit redder, the blue eyes a little bit paler, and the square jaw a little more aggressive. Joe at 10 was well able to look after himself. When he spoke, he looked you straight in the eye, but it was a challenge, not a confidence. He did not walk, he strutted like a young bantam cock, and he had all of his father's aggression but lacked the gentler side of Sam's nature. Joe asked neither favours nor quarter, and offered none. He and Sam quarrelled frequently, but with that grudging admiration that is held for a respected adversary. Joe's respect for his father was never a matter of doubt, but his love was reserved for Mary. These things apart, Joseph Hardacre had neither fear nor affection for God or man. Harry came in with Joe. 3 years Joe's junior, warm and loving, he was a gentle child, completely out of place in the harsh environment into which he had been born. When they came into the room, Harry stood a little behind Joe. He always seemed to stand a little behind someone, wide, innocent blue eyes peering inquiringly out of the soft oval of his face. His hair was much darker than that of his brother, almost as black as Mary's, and his lips still had the remains of their baby fullness, making him look all the more like his mother. He had Mary's hands, long and slender, though not yet marred by the calluses of years of housework. He was in all things the antithesis of Joe. Joe was the doer, Harry the thinker. Joe welcomed conflict as an expression of his manhood. Harry avoided it. Joe sold newspapers. Harry wanted desperately to read them. It was a near incredible fact that, in that completely illiterate household, Harry had taught himself the alphabet and was already beginning to learn the written formation of simple words. Joe went out morning and night and sold newspapers, contributing a penny or two to the household budget and keeping alive his fierce independence. Harry would spend most of the day looking through the paper, which Joe had brought home the night before, picking out the words he knew and maybe learning one or two new ones. Mary loved Joe, because he was to her another Sam, a man's man, ready and willing to accept whatever challenge a hostile world might offer him. Sam loved Harry because he was gentle like Mary, perhaps like his daughter would have been had she lived, and because Harry was the clever one who strived for learning. Sam would do anything to further Harry's desire to study, and would, much to Joe's disgust, bring him little picture books to help him with his reading.
"When'll tea be ready?" asked Sam.
"Soon," replied Mary.
"Come on then, lass, take the porter," said Sam.
He went to the cupboard and got out the Victoria and Albert wedding mug and filled it with black beer.
"Where's thine, Sam?"
"A cup of tea with me mutton pie'll do for me," he replied.
"Thou'll take thy half of the porter, or I'll toss it out of the window," said Mary.
Sam did not argue. He knew that she would do it. He went to the cupboard, got another mug, and divided the porter between them.
"By gum, but that tastes good," said Sam,
as he took a long, satisfying pull at the black bear.
"Do they lads want their milk now?" he asked,
turning to the children, who were sitting on the floor by the brass fender.
"Yes, Dad," said Harry eagerly, jumping up and coming over to his father.
"No," said Mary firmly. "They can have it hot when Joe comes in from his paper round."
Longingly, Harry eyed the enamel can containing the fresh milk, but he said nothing and went back to rejoin his brother at the fire. Sam and Mary did not talk a lot. They had no need to. They never felt uncomfortable in each other's company. They sat silently drinking their porter.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?